Morning. Well, just this week in the news, I'm sure you're all aware, there was another senseless shooting and killing in Rhode Island where 11 students were shot, 2 were killed, 9 were wounded. And I think I heard yesterday, it just found the guy that did it, he was dead as well. There was also a mass shooting earlier this week in Australia. You probably heard about that in Bondi Beach in Australia at a Jewish celebration. 15 were killed there, 40 injured, which made it the deadliest attack in the history of Australia, or mass incident in the history of Australia. Death and destruction are commonplace in our world. I think we see that. There are over 4,000 babies aborted in our country every single day. We sometimes don't dwell on that or even think about that. So we have children out there killing other children. We have adults killing unborn children. We have violence and hatred everywhere in our world today. But that's not new. I mean, this has been happening since Cain killed Abel, way back thousands of years ago. But I think we will have to admit that we are living in a troubled time in history. We can all feel that. We can all feel that this is a troubled time in history. There is no denying that truth. But the question I have is why? Well, to help us understand this question, I want to turn to Romans 3. So if you want to turn to Romans 3, you can, or you can just listen as I read. Romans 3, starting in verse 10. I'm going to read Romans 3, starting in verse 10. There is none righteous, no, not one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks after God. They have all turned aside. This is Paul, and he's actually quoting from the Old Testament, from the book of Psalms, continuing on, verse 12. They have all turned aside. They have together become unprofitable. There is none who does good, no, not one. Their throat is an open tomb. With their tongues they have practiced deceit. The poison of asp is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursings and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways. In the way of peace they have not known. And then verse 18. There is no fear of God before their eyes. So the question as to why the world is the way it is today can be answered in verse 18. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Men simply do not fear God in the world today. God does not enter the picture in many people's lives. God is not a part of their decision making. God is not a part of any decision that is made in our government either. In Washington, D.C., the thought of God or what he thinks is not considered at all. And I'd say that probably in most of the homes in this country, not all, but most, God is not part of the picture either, not part of the thought process. There is no fear of God, so men act and do whatever they want in their own best interest. There is no fear of God before their eyes. So the question for the sermon today is, do you have the fear of God before your eyes? That's what I'm going to talk about today. Now, the fear of God is a concept in the Bible, talked about throughout the Bible, Old and New Testament. It's mentioned hundreds of times. It's actually kind of remarkable when you go through and you do a search for the fear of God, it's everywhere. It's mentioned over and over again. So it is this fear of God that I'm going to talk about today. We know in Ecclesiastes, Solomon talked about this. This is a verse we probably all know by heart in Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13. Solomon said, "Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind." I mean, that's a scripture we all know very well. We might even have it on a plaque or a mug or something. The Bible tells us that Solomon was the wisest man who ever lived, outside of Jesus Christ, of course. So when he says the entire sum of life is to fear God, then we ought to think about what that means. What does it mean to fear God? What is he talking about? So I want to look further into this fear of God today and the fruits of that fear. Now, Webster defines fear, if you look at Webster's dictionary, it defines fear as an unpleasant, strong emotion from anticipation of danger, a worry about things that might happen, or a reverent awe, especially regarding God. But when most people think about fear, they think about that type of fear, being terrified, anticipation of danger. We've all felt that kind of fear to one level or another. You've had fear maybe of heights, maybe you're afraid of spiders. Not that I'm afraid of spiders. It wouldn't be manly to be afraid of spiders. But we've all had that type of fear, right? Or maybe it's that instant fear, like you're driving down the highway and somebody pulls out in front of you and you just get that jolt of adrenaline in your stomach. That type of fear, that terror. That is part of it. And this term, fear of the Lord, does have those elements of fear like that in it. But it is mostly used to instill a reverence or an awe or a respect for how powerful and how holy God really is. We'll see as we go through this, you can see both aspects in this term, fear of God. The word used for fear in this verse here in Ecclesiastes 12, when it says, fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of mankind, is the Hebrew word yirah. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that quite right, but I think it's yirah. And it means to be made, it can mean, it has two meanings. First, it means to be made afraid, dreadful, put in fearful reverence, or a terrible act. But it also can mean to fear morally, to have reverence, to stand in awe, to honor, and to respect. So we can see there's two sides to this term. Now this word, yirah, occurs 331 times in the Bible. Like I said, it's all over the place. And sometimes it doesn't mean to be terrified, frozen in fear. Example, that's in Exodus 20. I'm just going to look at an example of that type of fear. It's in Exodus 20, if you want to turn there, or you can just listen to me read. It's when Moses was receiving the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, verse 18. Exodus 20, verse 18. It says, when the people saw the thunder and lightning, this is when he was receiving the Ten Commandments, and heard the trumpet and saw the mountain in smoke, they trembled with fear. So this is the kind of fear, same word, yirah, that's trembling. They're afraid. They stayed at a distance and said to Moses, speak to us yourself and we will listen, but do not have God to speak to us, for we will die. So they were terrified. Now verse 20. Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. God has come to test you, so that the fear of God will be with you and keep you from sinning. So here he's talking about this fear of God, and it's the same word. So sometimes this fear of God is actually terror of impending harm. The Israelites were terrified. But most times, it means to stand in awe of God's greatness and to have a proper reverence and respect for who he is. And you can see that it's kind of intertwined. An example, this is in Psalm 33. Psalm 33, verse 8, where it says, let all the earth fear the Lord. Same term. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. So now we see this term, fear of the Lord, meaning reverence or standing in awe of how awesome, what awe is, the root word of awesome, see how awesome God's power is. Either way, it means to respect God, to respect him for who he is and what he has done for us. I just want to reference Psalm 89 now. Psalm 89, verses 6 and 7. Psalm 89, verses 6 and 7 says, for who in the heavens can be compared to the Lord? Who among the sons of the mighty can be likened to God? God is greatly to be feared in the assembly of the saints and to be held in reverence by all those around him. So now we're told that God is greatly to be feared and to be held in reverence by all around him. God demands that we fear him and stand in awe of who he is. And that's a concept that most people in this world don't understand, or they don't practice. Most people don't fear God. And as a result, his commandments get compromised. And I think compromise is one of the biggest things that happens when we lose that fear of God. We compromise. When we don't have the fear of God before our eyes, we get lazy and we compromise what we know to be right. An example of this, You can turn here if you want in Leviticus 10. We're going to look at an example of this compromise when we kind of lose that respect for who God is in a story or an account here in Leviticus 10 verses 1 to 3. It's a story about Nadab and Abihu. Story that I'm sure you already know, but I'm going to read it here in Leviticus 10 verses 1 to 3. Of course, Nadab and Abihu were the sons of Aaron. Verse 1 says that. Then Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it and put incense in it and offered profane fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. So fire went out from the Lord and devoured them. So Nadab and Abihu offered profane fire to God, and God killed them. And they died before the Lord. Verse 3. And Moses said to Aaron, "This is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near to me, I must be..." Let me read that again. "This is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come to me, I must be regarded as holy. And before all people, I must be glorified." This is God speaking. It says that they offered profane fire before the Lord. Profane means to treat as common something that is sacred and holy. They treated something common that was supposed to be sacred and holy. We cannot treat God as common. It says he must be regarded as holy. That is what the fear of God is all about. And in verse 3, Moses said to Aaron again, he said, "This is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near to me, I must be regarded as holy. And before all the people, I must be glorified." So here in this passage, these two young men were killed because they did not treat God and his commandments the proper way. In other words, they did not fear God in the way that they should have. Now, this seems kind of terrifying on the face of it. You think, man, it doesn't seem like such a big deal, and they were killed. And isn't God supposed to be about love? Isn't God love? I mean, we read that in the New Testament, right? 1 John 4, verse 8 says, He who does not love does not know God, for God is love. So God is love. Now, how do you make those two things fit? And we're even told in Romans 8, verse 15, that we can call God our Father, Abba, which is a term of endearment for father. In Romans 8, verse 15, it says, "For you did not receive the spirit of bondage again to fear." So now it's kind of telling us that we shouldn't be afraid. "But you received the spirit of adoption, by whom we cry out, Abba, Father." So here in Romans 8, we are told not to fear. And we are told to cry out to God and call him Father, Abba, which again is a term of endearment. So it's a dichotomy. Two things that seem the opposite, but yet they're both true and can exist together. A dichotomy. These two concepts don't seem like they could coexist, but yet they do, and they can. Think about how Jesus taught us to pray in the model prayer. Think about the model prayer for a minute. He starts with, "Our Father, who art in heaven." Our Father, Abba, who art in heaven. But what's the next line? "Hallowed be your name." Hallowed means to regard as holy, reverence. So we have those two things existing together. Our Father, hallowed is his name. That's the fear. That's the fear part. We recognize who he is, and we give him the honor and the glory that he deserves. Now, there was no one closer to God the Father than, of course, his Son, Jesus Christ. And I just want to read in Isaiah 11. Isaiah 11 is a prophecy about Christ. And it talks about who he would be a little bit here in Isaiah 11. And it's interesting, and I want to read it. Isaiah 11, verses 1 to 3. Again, this is a prophecy about Jesus Christ. It gives an insight of who he would be in Isaiah 11, verses 1 to 3. It says, "Then shall come forth a rod from the stem of Jesse," talking about Jesus Christ, "and a branch that shall grow out of his roots." Verse 2, "The spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, and the spirit and the fear of the Lord. His delight is in the fear of the Lord." So this prophecy is saying that the spirit and knowledge, the knowledge of the fear of the Lord will be upon Jesus Christ. So Jesus Christ himself had fear of the Lord, or fear of God. Even though he was God, he had a respect and honor for his Father. Again, it's the same word used for fear here. It's yirah, meaning fear, reverence, or awe. Awesome. He was not afraid of his Father, terrified. But he had the respect, and he gave him the respect he deserved. He submitted his will to his Father's will. You can think about how he prayed before he was crucified in Gethsemane. He was submitted to his Father's will. Despite his own suffering, he had reverence to his Father. So there are two sides of this coin. God is our Father, but he also must be revered and treated with the utmost awe and respect. And that is the fear of the Lord. That's what we're talking about here throughout the Bible. And it's essential that we have this type of fear of God. Because what you fear ultimately controls what you do. What you fear ultimately controls your life. If you fear men, then your actions and your decisions will be influenced by that fear. But if you fear God, then your actions and your decisions will be influenced by that fear. And I think when we think about it, we know that's true. I want to look at a couple examples of this. I'm just going to go through a few examples here of this fear of God and how it influenced these people. First example was Abraham. We know Abraham obeyed God because he feared God. I'm going to go to Genesis 22. So I go through these examples. I think there's three or four. You can follow along or you can listen. I'm going to go to Genesis 22 now, verse 2. It says, then he said, talking to Abraham, this is of course when he was going to sacrifice his son Isaac. Then he said, take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him with a burnt offering on the side of a mountain which I shall tell you. So God is commanding Abraham to sacrifice the son that he loved. So you would think, well, if Abraham was willing to sacrifice his son, whom he obviously loved, it must be because he loved God even more, right? And maybe he did. But let's take a look in Genesis 22, verse 11. Genesis 22, verse 11 now, verse 11 and 12. It says, but the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. So he said, here I am. Verse 12. He said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. So in James 2, verse 23, you turn there, it calls Abraham a friend of God. So obviously Abraham did love God. That's not in question. But Abraham obeyed because he feared God. And we know that because it says it right there. For now I know that you feared God, because you did not withhold your son, your only son, from me. Abraham obeyed God, and as a result, he says, now I know you fear God. So we see this comparison between obedience and fearing God over and over, and we'll see it again here in this next example with the midwives. Next example is the midwives. At the time of Pharaoh, the midwives were told to kill all the firstborn baby boys because the Israelites at the time were multiplying and they're growing stronger and stronger in Egypt. And we're told that Pharaoh began to fear them. So we can see again who you fear and the decisions that you make, because Pharaoh was beginning to fear all these Israelites. He was afraid they were going to come up against him, and he feared them. And as a result, he told all the midwives to kill all the baby boys born. I'm going to read in Exodus 1 now. If you want to go to Exodus 1, you can. Exodus 1, verse 16. Exodus 1, verse 16 says, and he said, when you do the duties of the midwife for a Hebrew woman, for the Hebrew women, and see them on their birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill it. Again, he made his decision because he was afraid of the Israelites. But if it is a daughter, then you shall let it live. Verse 17, but the midwives feared God. They didn't fear Pharaoh. or they feared God more than Pharaoh, and they did not do as the Egyptian commanded them, and they saved the male children alive. So you can see, who you fear dictates the decisions you will make. Pharaoh feared Israelites, so he ordered all the young boys to be killed. But the midwife says here, they feared God, so they saved the male children. Who you fear dictates your decisions. Now, I'm sure the midwives did fear Pharaoh as well. I mean, he was an evil man. He enslaved a whole race of people. He even murdered their children. But they feared God more, and that's the key. So it's not just that they feared God, it's that they feared God more than they feared Pharaoh. Fear of God brings obedience to God over man. Now, the third example. The third example is of Pharaoh, talking about Pharaoh. The third example I hear is about Pharaoh, because he did not fear God. And we know that fear of God produces obedience, and the absence of fear of God leads to disobedience. I'm going to turn to Exodus 9 now. If you want to turn there, you can. Exodus 9, verse 27 to 28. So we know here in Exodus 9, there had been seven plagues. You remember the account. There were seven plagues that were unleashed. And the seventh plague was hail and fire. And it destroyed everything that was left out in the field, both man and beast. And all the vegetation was wiped out. And it was this point in Exodus 9 that Pharaoh says to Moses. Now, Pharaoh was getting beat down by this point. There was already seven plagues. Hail and fire had just come down. And he says here in Exodus 9, verse 27, and Pharaoh sent, and he called for Moses and Aaron, and he said to them, I have sinned this time. So now Pharaoh's kind of changing his tune, right? The Lord is righteous, and my people and I are wicked. Sounds like he's humble and repentant here, doesn't it? Verse 28, entreat the Lord that there be no more mighty thundering and hail, for this is enough. He had enough. I will let you go, and you shall stay no longer. Sounds like he had a turn of heart. Sounded like he was humble and repentant, and he wanted to let the people go. But of course, we know that isn't true, because there were more plagues to come, right? And Moses knew that Pharaoh would not obey, and he tells him how he knew in verse 29 and 30. I'm going to continue reading Exodus 9, verse 29 and 30. So Moses said to him, as soon as I have gone out of the city, I will spread out my hands to the Lord. The thunder will cease. There will be no more hail, that you may know that the earth is the Lord's. Now, verse 30. But as for you and your servants, I know that you will not yet fear the Lord. He knew that it was all fake. He was saying one thing, but he didn't believe it. He was a hypocrite. You do not yet fear the Lord. And we know, of course, there were more plagues after. Moses said God would bring the plague to an end. But he also knew that Pharaoh would return to his old ways. And he told him, I know that you do not yet fear the Lord. Now the fourth example, and the last one I have, is that of Saul. We know that Saul disobeyed God. You probably remember the account that God commanded Saul to utterly destroy all the Amalekites and all that belonged to them. But he destroyed only what he wanted to destroy, and he kept what he wanted. You know, he kept a few things back for himself, which wasn't what God told him to do. So God sent Samuel to confront him about this. And I want you to listen to Saul's excuse of why he did what he did. 1 Samuel, this is in 1 Samuel 15. This was Saul's excuse of why he didn't obey God. 1 Samuel 15, verse 24. Then Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandments of the Lord and your words. So he admitted that he did wrong. But then he gives an excuse. Because I feared the people, and I obeyed their voice. He feared the people, and he obeyed their voice. So disobedience doesn't always mean that we don't fear God at all, because Saul did fear God. He knew who God was. It just means that we fear people before we fear God. And that's just what Saul did. He feared people more than he feared God. Fear of God produces obedience. I think we can see that through these examples. We saw that with Abraham and the Hebrew wives. But without the fear of God, it produces disobedience and compromise. And you can see that happened with Pharaoh and, of course, with Saul. So compromise is the thing that will get us. Compromise. Compromise will get us. When we compromise God's commandments, we start to lose focus on who God really is. We start to lose focus on the fact that he is the Almighty, the Alpha, the Omega, the beginning, the end. He created all the universe in all of its complexity. When we start to not have that in the forefront of our mind, we compromise. We compromise on God's law. Now, I was thinking about this. I was thinking about a really good place that you can really get the fear of God and the awe of God back into your life is when you're sitting out in the woods somewhere, out in nature, wherever we may be. Maybe you're just looking around at all that he created, and you think about the complexity of it all. It's at nighttime, maybe, and you can stare into space at the billions and billions of stars. And then as you're lost in the vast expanse of space and all that he created, you feel the sting of a mosquito bite you right there in the neck. And you realize that somehow, through all this expanse, that mosquito that has a brain the size smaller than the end of a pin, probably, somehow found you out there sitting in the middle of the woods. And you think, how did he do that? How was a little mosquito, brain so microscopic you can't even see it, know that I was sitting here, come here and bite me on the neck? Well, it's because he smelled the carbon dioxide that you were breathing. Somehow they can smell it, they can sense it, and what you're breathing, and they come and they find you. But not only that, once one mosquito finds you and bites you in the neck, they send out pheromones to all the other mosquitoes around, and we've all felt this happen, and now all the mosquitoes are there biting you in the neck. And you think to yourself, how can this be? How did a God that created all this in the universe, all these stars, this expanse, also create this tiny little mosquito with that tiny little brain? And somehow he knew to bite me here in the neck, and he told all his friends to do the same. And you sit in awe of his creation and how awesome that it is. That is the fear of God. That is how you can get that fear of God back, when you realize how awesome he is and how insignificant you are in comparison. Without that fear of God, disobedience and compromise start to creep in. That's when compromise happens. We start to believe that it really doesn't matter how we worship God. Any day will do. Any day is as good as any other day to worship God. We can pick any day to be the Sabbath. It doesn't matter what God says. We can convince ourselves that Christmas and Easter are fine to celebrate. God really doesn't care how we worship him, as long as we worship. We can change how we worship. Just think about Nahab and Abihu. They thought they could change it. You start to compromise. You start to forget the fear of the Lord. You start to forget who God really is. Which brings me to my main point today. Now you're thinking, man, all this. And now he's getting to his main point. This brings me to my main point today, and that is hypocrisy. Now you may think, well, what does hypocrisy have to do with the fear of the Lord? But I think it has everything to do with the fear of the Lord. When I was thinking about hypocrisy, it is the reason that I started thinking about this topic. Last week, I started thinking about, why is there hypocrisy in the church? And like it or not, there is sometimes hypocrisy in the church. Then I thought, well, why is there hypocrisy in my own life? And like it or not, there is hypocrisy in my own life as well. And my conclusion was that hypocrisy creeps in when we lose that fear of God. When we start to forget who he really is, and we begin to compromise. I want you to turn over to 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 17. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 17. It says, since you call on a father who judges each person's work impartially. Live out your time as foreigners with reverent fear. So very first verse here says, since you call on Father who judges you, you're supposed to live as foreigners with reverent fear. Verse 18. For you know that it is not with perishable things such as gold and silver that you were redeemed from the empty ways of life handed down for you from your ancestors, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. He was chosen from the creation of the world, but was revealed in these last time for your sake. Through him you believe in God who raised you from the dead and glorified, who raised him from the dead and glorified him, and so your faith and hope are in God. So it starts in verse 17. It says, you call him Father and he judges you, and because of that, live in reverent fear. So again, we see this same theme of living in fear. And why should we live in reverent fear? Verse 18 says, because you know that it was not with perishable things like gold or silver that you were redeemed. You were redeemed with the precious blood of Jesus Christ, the Lamb without blemish. We were redeemed with something more valuable than gold and silver. And that is why we should have that reverent fear. Because of what has been sacrificed for you. But if you start to take that gift lightly and you start to fear men more than God, then you become the hypocrite. That's how you become a hypocrite. If we say, I accept the sacrifice of Jesus Christ and I will follow him publicly, but then live a different way of life privately, then we are hypocrites. That's what hypocrisy is. And that really is the main focus of my sermon today, as I said. Why are there hypocrites in the church? And there are hypocrites, I know, because I am one. I admit it. And why do we sometimes preach one thing and live another? This was the question I was asking myself when I started this sermon earlier this week. And the answer to the question that I came up with is why sometimes we become hypocrites is because sometimes we fear men more than we fear God. And that's kind of the theme I've been trying to lay out here. It happened to Pharaoh. He feared the Israelites. He didn't fear God. It happens to the Pharisees, as we will see here in a minute. The Pharisees were called hypocrites again and again by Jesus Christ because they talked one way in public but lived another way in private. And if we're not careful, it can happen to us as well. That's why the fear of God is so important. That awe, that reverence for God who sent his only begotten Son to die for us. And that awe and reverence for the God who created all things needs to be in the forefront of our minds. If we lose that fear, we can start to fear men more than God. And we can start to compromise and we become hypocrites, teaching one thing in public and living another way in private. We cannot claim that we believe in God publicly and live another way privately. The very fact that we were paid for by the blood of Jesus Christ, the most precious thing in the universe, is a reason why we should always walk in fear. Now, the parents out there, you parents especially, I think need to be thinking about this. Because I think one of the main reasons that most young people, if you ask them, young people who have left the faith or are thinking about leaving the faith, one of the main reasons they give is they see hypocrisy. I mean, not just in our church and other churches, you hear the same thing from young people as a complaint. They say, I see hypocrisy in the church. Why do I want to stay here? They're all hypocrites. And maybe they even see hypocrisy in their own parents. Of course, none of us are perfect. I mean, obviously. We try to be, but we can't be. That is why we must keep the fear of God before our eyes and live what we teach. It's vitally important. The young people today have enough to deal with. You know, this younger generation has a lot of anxiety and depression and loneliness. You hear about that. We hear about a lack of purpose that many young men especially seem to have, meaning for their life. The last thing they need to do is see hypocrisy in the church or in their families. And we need to be held responsible, and we will be held responsible if we cause one of these young people to stumble in the faith. So it's something we need to take seriously. If you meet people who say they fear God, but in their lives they live the opposite way, opposed to God, it doesn't matter what they say, they don't really fear God, do they? They fear men. They fear other people's opinions. They don't fear God. If you are a hypocrite, you don't fear God. A hypocrite fears man. And that's exactly what the Pharisees did. I'm going to turn to Luke 12 now. Luke 12, verses 1 to 7. This is talking about the Pharisees and their hypocrisy. I think it's a very interesting group of verses here in Luke 12, verses 1 to 7. Again, Luke 12, verse 1. It says, meanwhile, when a crowd of many thousands had gathered, so there was a crowd of many thousands that were gathering together. So they were trampling on one another. There were so many that they were trampling each other. Jesus began to speak. But notice what it says. He began to speak first to his disciples. So he wasn't even speaking to the crowd when he said this. He was speaking to his disciples. And he says, be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. He's telling his disciples to be on guard for hypocrisy. Verse 2. There is nothing concealed that will not be disclosed or hidden that will not be made known. What you have said in the dark will be heard in the daylight, and what you have whispered in the ear in the inner rooms will be proclaimed from the rooftops. I tell you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who can kill the body, and after that, do no more. But I will show you whom you should fear. Now he's talking about, this is who you should be afraid of. Fear him who, after the body has been killed, has the authority to throw you into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies, yet not one of them is forgotten by God? Indeed, the very hairs of your head are numbered. Now it says something kind of the opposite here. It says, even the hairs of your head are numbered. And it says, don't be afraid, for you are more worthy than the sparrows. So there's a crowd of many thousands gathered, and Jesus was speaking directly to his disciples. And he says, be on guard and look out, be alert, because there's a danger that you could slip into hypocrisy. The word hypocrite, I looked it up, it's a Greek word, hypokrisis, which means to play act, like in a theater, like you're playing a role, like an actor in a theater. That's what the word means. You're just playing a role. And the Pharisees were playing a role. They're acting all godly, like they feared God in public, but in private they lived, of course, a different way. A hypocrite is someone who is acting, showing them a version of themselves in public who they're not really in private. And hopefully that doesn't describe you. Sadly, sometimes it does describe me. I'll admit it. And if you're honest with yourself, it probably describes you at times as well. In verses 2 and 3, Jesus points out that hypocrisy as being foolish and futile, because that which is done in secret will eventually be known in the open. For a hypocrite, people think you're spiritual. They think you're a Christian. They think you're walking with God. They think you fear God. But it's all a show. It's just an act. You're an actor. That's what the word hypocrite means. You think you can fool me and you can fool others, but God knows the truth. And one day it will be exposed. Now, verses 4 to 7, he basically tells us to fear God and not men. Basically, verses 4 to 7. I'm going to read it again. It says, I tell you, my friends, this is after talking about the Pharisees and their hypocrisy. I tell you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who can kill the body, and after that, do no more. But I will show you him who you should fear. Fear him who, after you has been killed, has the authority to throw you into hell, which means Gehenna, or it's reference to the Valley of Hinnom, which was a valley near there that they burned up trash. They threw all the refuse and burned it up. So here we see this dichotomy again. It says to fear God in verse 5, again and again, fear God. I'm going to tell you who you should fear, it says. But then in verse 6 and 7 it says, but don't be afraid. And that's the dichotomy. Both sides are true. We should fear, but yet we shouldn't be afraid. Because in verse 6 it says, are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies? Yet none of them is forgotten by God. Indeed, the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Don't be afraid. You are worth more than these sparrows. That's verse 6 and 7. So again, two sides of the coin. It says, fear God, but don't be afraid. Two things that seem opposite, but both are true. He tells us that God is concerned with the sparrows, and he is concerned with you, even to the point he knows how many hairs are on your head. I want to just read Psalm 89, verse 6 and 7 again, just as a little reminder here. As we get towards the end of this section, Psalm 89, verse 6 and 7 says, for who in the heavens can be compared to the Lord? Who among the sons of the mighty can be likened to God? God is greatly to be feared in the assembly of the saints, and to be held in reverence to all those around him. The fear of God should always be before our eyes, as we read about in Romans 3 at the very beginning. So now, towards the end of the sermon here, I want to look at two examples. An example of a man who feared God, an example of a woman who feared God. Now, these aren't a specific man or a specific woman. These are just characteristics of a man and characteristics of a woman who fears God. And I'm just going to quickly show you these here getting towards the end of the sermon. First, a man who fears God. If you want to turn to Psalm 112. Psalm 112. Now I just want you to notice what it says at the end of Psalm 111, just before Psalm 112 starts. The end of Psalm 111 in verse 10 says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all those who do his commandments. His praises endure forever. Then the very next verse is, of course, the beginning of Psalm 112, which is the psalm I want to read. Psalm 112, verse 1, says, praise the Lord. Blessed is the man who fears the Lord, who delights greatly in his commandments. So this psalm is about a man who fears the Lord and the characteristics of this man. But not the kind of man who fears the Lord in terror and dread, but one who has awe and reverence and respect for God. Because you'll notice in that very first verse, it says, blessed is a man who fears the Lord, who delights greatly in his commandments. So now it puts the fear of the Lord right with delight. Fear and delight coexisting together. This is a type of fear that brings happiness. It's a reverent fear. It's an awe kind of fear. Now I'm going to read the rest of these verses here in Psalm 112 because it describes a man who fears the Lord. And just think about this man as we go through this. Verse 1, praise the Lord. Blessed is a man who fears the Lord, who delights greatly in his commandments. His descendants will be mighty on the earth. The generation of the upright will be blessed. Wealth and riches will be in his house, and his righteousness endures forever. Unto the upright there arises light in the darkness. He is gracious and full of compassion for the righteous. A good man deals graciously and lends. He will guide his affairs in discretion. Surely he will never be shaken. The righteous will be in everlasting remembrance. He will not be afraid of evil tidings. His heart is steadfast, trusting in the Lord. His heart is established. He will not be afraid until he sees his desire upon his enemies. He has dispersed abroad. He has given to the poor. His righteousness endures forever. His horn shall be exalted with honor. So these are the characteristics of a man who fears God. I just want to hit upon a couple of them. First, we see his descendants. Verse 2 says, his descendants will be mighty on the earth. His generations will be upright and will be blessed. His fear of God has an effect not only on his own life, but on his children's, on his grandchildren's, on his descendants. It says they will be mighty on the earth. That fear of God is being passed on to the next generation, to this man who fears God. And the fear of God keeps him from being a hypocrite, right? We just talked about that. Our children can see when we are committed to God's way of life without compromise, without hypocrisy. And that is passed on from generation to generation. Then verse 3 says, wealth and riches will be in his house, and his righteousness endures forever. Now, I don't think this is talking about physical wealth here, or physical riches, because that's not what's important. That's not where our treasure is. Our treasure is in heaven to a kingdom yet in the future. Then verse 5 says, a good man deals graciously and lends, and he will guide his affairs with discretion. So a man who fears God is generous with whatever he has. Then verse 6 says, surely he will never be shaken. The righteous will be an everlasting remembrance. He will not be afraid of evil tidings. His heart is steadfast, trusting in the Lord. Now we see that this man who fears God is unafraid of this world. He is not shaken because he doesn't fear man. He only fears God. Setbacks and trials in life do not shake him because he trusts God. The best thing that any man can do in this life, for his career, for his marriage, for his family, is to be a man who fears God. It's just that simple. Now on to a woman who fears God. The last example I have here is a woman who fears God. Of course, that's in Proverbs 31. We know that Proverbs 31 speaks about a virtuous woman, right? And you could give an entire sermon just on this proverb, but I'm just going to touch on a few verses here in Proverbs 31. If you want to turn there, you can. In Proverbs 31, talking about this woman, in verse 30, it says, Proverbs 31, verse 30, it says, charm is deceitful and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord shall be praised. So the woman described here in Proverbs 31 is described as a woman who fears the Lord. And a woman like that should be praised. It says the same thing we just read in Psalms 112 about a man who fears the Lord. He should be praised. So first, this woman who fears the Lord is strong, just like the man that we just read about in Psalm 112. She is not anxious about the future. So in Proverbs 31, verse 25, you'll notice what it says. In Proverbs 31, verse 25. I'm going to read this from the New International Version. It says, she is clothed with strength and dignity, and she can laugh at the days to come. She is clothed with strength, and she is morally strong. She can laugh at the hard times. Just like the man who fears God that we read about in Psalm 112, she is not shaken. This woman who fears the Lord is not shaken by this world because she doesn't fear this world. She fears God. Second, she has wisdom, Proverbs 31, verse 26. Proverbs 31, verse 26 says, she opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is a law of kindness. It's no surprise that the woman who fears the Lord opens her mouth with wisdom. Because in Proverbs 9, I think I already read it, it says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. That's where wisdom comes from. Third, a woman who fears the Lord will not live just for herself. She isn't a selfish person. She lives for others, especially her husband. Proverbs 31 again, now verses 11 and 12. Proverbs 31, 11 and 12 says, for her husband has full confidence in her and lacks nothing of value. She brings him good, not harm, all the days of her life. So a woman who fears the Lord will have complete trust of her husband, has the complete trust of her husband. And she brings him good. Fourth, she cares for the needy. Proverbs 31, verse 20. She opens her arms to the poor and extends her hands to the needy. She opens her arms to those who need the most. And finally, I mean, there's many more attributes you could bring out, but the last one I'm going to bring out is in Proverbs 31, verse 30 again. A woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Proverbs 31, verse 30. Charm is deceitful and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. So a woman who fears the Lord is confident, not anxious about the future. She has wisdom, she is strong, and she brings her husband honor, and she opens her arms to the needy. And lastly, a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. So in conclusion, I will ask the same question I started with today from Romans 3. Do you have the fear of God before your eyes? Every day before your eyes, do you have the fear of God? Psalm 89, verses 6 to 7. I read this already. I'm going to read it again. Psalms 89, verses 6 and 7 says, "For those who are in heaven, for who in heaven can be compared to the Lord? Who among the sons of the mighty can be likened to the Lord?" God is greatly to be feared in the assembly of the saints and to be held in reverence by all those around him. God demands that we fear him and that we stand in awe of who he is and what he has done for us. And that is a concept that most people in this world do not understand. God does not enter the picture of most people's lives. He's not part of the decision-making process. He's not even part of the conversation. Around the dinner table, it never comes up. So the question today is, do you have the fear of God before your eyes? Because if you do, it will guard you against compromise, and it will guard you against hypocrisy in your life. Hopefully I showed you that as we went along. So the question is, do I fear God? It's a question most people will never ask themselves. But it's an important question, because proper fear of God is not only the much needed cure for the hypocrisy in our lives, but is also the key to having a truly blessed and meaningful life. And we read that when we read Psalm 112 and of course Proverbs 31. Now I want to read Ecclesiastes 12 verse 13 again. You don't need to turn there, you know what it says. It says, "The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." Solomon said that this is the end of the matter. Now, you know, throughout Solomon's life, he grappled with life's most pressing issues. He basically said, "I heard it all. I've seen it all. I've done it all. I've examined it all. I've tried everything you could even imagine to try." He had money, he had power, he had knowledge, he had possessions, he had fame. And he examined it all at the end of his life. And ultimately he reached the conclusion on what really matters and what impacts the human experience the most in a beneficial way, brings the most happiness. He thought about it, and many thought, well, maybe it would be many money, maybe it would be power, maybe fame, but he didn't mention any of those things. Instead he said, "Fear God, keep his commandments, because this is the whole duty of man." Fearing God eliminates hypocrisy in our lives. Solomon examined life from every angle, and he concluded there is an undeniable relationship between fearing God and obedience, and of course the blessings that happen after that. Now I'm going to end today with reading one more small group of scriptures in Psalm 128. You can just listen. I'm going to turn to Psalm 128, and then we'll wrap it up. Psalm 128. "Blessed is everyone who fears the Lord." Everyone who fears the Lord is blessed, who walks in his ways. "When you eat the labor of your hands, you shall be happy, and it shall be well with you. Your wife shall be a fruitful vine in the heart of your house. Your children are like olive plants all around the table. Behold, thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord. The Lord bless you out of Zion, and may you see the good of Jerusalem all the days of your life. Yes, may you see your children's children." When you boil it all down, life is all about a proper relationship with God. And to have that proper relationship, you must fear God and keep his commandments.